You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, February 17th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, to tape, in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Folks, it's vacation week at the Majority Report, but it's not a vacation for your ears, because we have 4 or 5 days of all new material for you, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, for your freebies today and for you members, you'll be hearing an interview I did with Michael Mann on Keystone XL and the implications of the State Department recent release of the Environmental Impact Report. Then Shenna Bellows, running for the Senate against Susan Collins in Maine as a Democrat. And then members, you will get Suzanne Mettler from September 2011, where she talks about the submerged state. This is one of my favorite interviews over the past couple of years, because it really outlines how we are all on the dole. Whether you are one of those makers or those supposed just takers. I got news for you. We're all takers. Which is why we all got to get back. Meanwhile, I am on vacation right now. I can only imagine how much I am dying to get back into this very seat that I am speaking from right now. Because now that Myla has just reached that age where she is self-sufficient, I'm no longer getting her milk, changing her diapers, whatever. Could I have a drink? Yeah, go get it yourself now. Next up, Saul. Whatever it is. Ooh, I pooped my pants. He doesn't even talk. He doesn't even tell you. He just cries. You got to figure it out. So, and is he sleeping? No. So that vacation where I was going to get all this rest, not happening. And I can only imagine what will happen tomorrow. All this week, folks, we've got new interviews for you. We've got people talking about Vermont's single payer. We've got folks talking about Upton Sinclair, Social Security and Medicare, the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We've got someone speaking about any remaining Affordable Care Act challenges in the state Supreme Court, and this question of recess appointments. A case you haven't heard much about at all. That's in front of the Supreme Court as we speak. I've got people talking about hotspots. You know what hotspots are? Well, you'll have to tune in this week. And Triumph from the Deep Archives. Triumph, the comic insult dog. The Deep Archives for like 30
the
minutes.
Insult comic dog. You had it backwards there.
Well, it doesn't matter. He's not around to change it. Insulting me and Janine, but more me. All that and more this week. So here it is. Michael Mann, Shenna Bellows, And for you members, also, we'll get Suzanne Mettler. We'll be back live in a week, but there's still lots to listen over the next couple of days. So, Michael, let's before we get into the implications of this decision, just give us a sense of we saw a report that was released by the State Department. I guess it was last Friday.
Right.
Tell us what that report is, how long we've been waiting for it, what the implications of that report are.
Sure thing. So this is a report from the State Department that is supposed to be an assessment of essentially a cost-benefit analysis for the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. And it was supposed to assess the potential damages, environmental damages, the potential contribution to greenhouse gas emissions, which of course are what is responsible for climate change and warming of the planet and all the impacts associated with that. And so there was a draft of the report some months ago, and then there was a comment period, and my understanding was that there were thousands of comments that were received, many of them quite critical about the ways in which the report had actually understated some of the costs, some of the risks, some of the potential environmental impacts of the construction of the pipeline. And so now the report has appeared. I think there is a final comment period before it's finalized. But one of the criticisms by many observers is that they haven't really dealt with some of the substantive criticisms in the original draft of the report in such a way that the report still appears to understate the potential damages associated with the construction of the pipeline. And, of course, the more that the report understates the damages and the costs and the risks, the more likely it is that we will make the wrong decision to build this pipeline in the face of quite a bit of evidence that it would be a bad thing to do.
Now, we should also just remind people that the reason why the State Department is doing this report and this assessment is because they basically have to sign off on the northern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline because it crosses an international border, that is our border with Canada, and yep. would presumably send this tar sands. I mean, it's not quite accurate to say that it's oil, is it? I mean, tell us what's underneath the ground up there in Alberta.
Yeah, I mean, we call it tar sands. Sometimes it's called tar oil, but that's really a misnomer because this stuff is really nasty. It's substantially bitumen, this sort of thick, gooey petroleum substance. And what that means is to get the actual usable petroleum oil out of it, there is a fair amount of refining that has to be done, and that comes with additional costs. That comes with additional costs in terms of the energy that has to go into the refining process and in terms of the actual dollar cost of, how much it really costs to use this for energy, use this very dirty oil for energy. And so ironically, at a time when the president has stated his commitment to making sure that we move in the direction that we need to move, away from fossil fuel energy, building this pipeline would facilitate the continued mining of the dirtiest source of fossil fuel energy that we know of, dirtiest in terms of its environmental impacts, and dirtiest in terms of how much energy and cost goes into getting the energy that's contained within the petroleum.
And so getting back also to that first draft report, my understanding is that the criticism of that first draft was not simply from people outside of the government, but that, in fact, the EPA weighed in and said that the work that had been done in the preparation, at least of the draft, was just simply not up to snuff when it came to measuring environmental impact.
That's right. And in fact, I was encouraged by some comments that I saw by the president, by President Obama, just within the last 24 hours, where he sort of qualified the implications of this particular report by saying that he needs to see what the EPA has to say about this. He's going to need to look at other independent assessments of the true cost and the true risks associated with building the pipeline before he can render a decision. So some of us were a bit encouraged to see that this one particular report, the State Department report, which does appear to understate the risks, will not form the sole basis for the decision that will be made by the administration.
We should also say that there's some controversy around the firm that was contracted to develop this report. In fact, my understanding is, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the State Department's Inspector General is looking into a potential conflict of interest between the company that that helped drafted this report, or at least do some of the research, and their relationship with TransCanada, which is the company looking to build Keystone XL.
Yeah, I mean, to some extent, it looks like the fox was in the hen house on this, that, you know, there was potential undue influence by those parties who clearly have a conflict of interest, who clearly stand to benefit from the construction of this pipeline. So that's just one in an increasingly long laundry list of reasons to be, you know, somewhat skeptical or even suspicious about this report. And I'll tell you, even today now, there is news of a study that just appeared in one of our most revered scientific journals, the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And this report shows that tar sands pollution is likely to contain far more of a particular toxic hydrocarbon called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs, far more of that than the report actually acknowledges. And this particular substance is extremely damaging to air quality and water quality. So it's another reminder of the sort of some of the hidden costs that may not have been taken into account, the damage done to the environment, the so-called environmental externalities, those negative impacts that haven't been properly taken into account in this assessment process. And that's in addition to the damages to our climate associated with the greenhouse gases that will result from this, these tar sand oils.
What is the parameters? I mean, what specifically was the State Department's report? What did it set out to do? I mean, is this a report that is weighing just the costs, or is it weighing the benefits as well? What was the mandate for this report?
Yeah, I think it's both of those. But obviously, it's, you know, if you don't account fully for the costs and the damages and the risks, then you're going to come out with a skewed assessment when it comes to the cost-benefit analysis. And that would be the argument, that that this report represents a skewed assessment, too rosy an outlook on the upside, because it doesn't properly take into account the full downside. And that's, you know, the environmental impacts, not just the greenhouse gases, but the threat to water quality and air quality. And there are some other aspects of this report that a number of observers are also concerned with. That sort of cost-benefit analysis, when it comes to looking at the footprint of the tar sands with respect to greenhouse gas emissions, what they're essentially looking at is an incremental, projected incremental impact, which is to say they're projecting forward and saying, well, what if we didn't build this pipeline? What would be likely to happen? And they argue implicitly that much of these tar sands oils, a sizable chunk of the available tar sands, would be mined and transported by rail, for example, by train. And so what they're saying is, well, a lot of this is going to make it out into, through rail. It's going to make it out into the global, you know, energy market anyways. And so the building of the Keystone XL pipeline wouldn't increase the net amount of that petroleum very much. Now, that argument seems to hinge on somewhat unrealistic projections. And I'll give you sort of a comparison here. Right now, there are only about 25,000 barrels of oil from the tar sands that are being transported by rail. What is projected is the better part of 1 million barrels of oil per day that would be transported if the pipeline is constructed. So
they're projecting forward a 40 times increase in the ability to basically extract and ship this oil, but with a capacity that is 1/40 in existence.
That's right.
Now.
That's right. Yeah,
that's pretty stunning. All right. Well, look, let's take a break. When we come back, I want to talk just briefly more about the report, but I want to talk about your piece in The Guardian where you say approving Keystone XL could be the biggest mistake of Obama's presidency. We're talking to Professor Michael Mann. We'll be right back after this. So, Professor, when we broke, you were basically giving us a report, if you will, on the State Department environmental impact report that they have now released in the approval process for the Keystone XL pipeline to cross the Canadian-American border. And you've outlined many of the ways in which their assessment of the downside risk is insufficient. And of course, this is not just your opinion. We heard from the EPA, and we've yet to hear from the EPA on the final draft. We heard it on the on one of the preliminary drafts, and they found it wanting in that regard. Yep. Just briefly, before we get into why you think this could be approving the Keystone XL could be the biggest mistake of Obama's presidency, just what ostensibly are the benefits that we're supposedly getting from this pipeline?
That's a great question, because the ostensible benefits are that this will aid in energy security, right? That there is a certain ongoing level of risk that we take in relying upon petroleum, oil from the Middle East and from other regions, unstable regions of the globe, places where we don't have very friendly relationships with the nations that own and are selling that petroleum. So the argument is, well, this is part of a strategy for meeting our energy demand through domestic energy sources. Now, the reason that that argument doesn't really stand up to scrutiny is that one of the key reasons for constructing the pipeline is to actually get this stuff down to the Gulf of Mexico, where it can then be shipped out and sold to other countries, and it will go out on the global market. And some estimates suggest that we will see very little benefit in terms of domestic energy production from the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline. If we're really...
My understanding is, too, is that some people argue fairly convincingly that in terms of the cost of domestic oil, that this could actually raise the cost, because so much of it is associated, the cost is associated with the refinement of something like this. And when you tie up the refinement capacity, that creates, in some ways, less supply of refined oil. But all right, let's we haven't really established the benefits for this country anyways in the shipping of this. But talk about why this may very well be the biggest mistake of Obama's presidency if he goes ahead and approves this with what we know today.
Right. And the title of my piece was a bit glib, a bit provocative in that regard. But I really do honestly believe that it could certainly be one of the greatest mistakes in his presidency for this reason. In his State of the Union address last week, the president was very affirmative about the importance, as he saw it, of making sure that we don't commit ourselves to going down a road in terms of our ongoing reliance on fossil fuels, where we leave behind a fundamentally degraded planet, climate, and environment for our children and grandchildren. And he said, and I thought it was one of the most poignant moments of his address, where he said he wants to be able to look them in the eye, his children, his grandchildren, decades from now, and say that we did all we could to make sure that we don't do that, that we don't leave behind a degraded planet for future generations. And he has engaged in some important executive actions over the last year, announced, for example, last summer, to try to combat this problem, for example, by holding coal-fired power plants to far more stringent standards in terms of the carbon that they're allowed to emit into the atmosphere, and that new coal-fired power plants would be required to sequester and capture and sequester that carbon. They wouldn't be allowed to put that CO2 into the atmosphere because we know that there is a great damage that's being done to our climate when we emit that carbon into the atmosphere. So here's the irony. He's taken a strong stance on new coal-fired power plants. And made a very convincing argument that we have to get away from building these new coal-fired power plants that are worsening the greenhouse warming problem and the climate change problem. And yet, if he were to approve the Keystone XL pipeline, that would be equivalent to building something like 50 new coal-fired power plants without any capture and sequestration that are putting all that carbon into the atmosphere. So there's an inconsistency. If he really believes that we can't continue to build these coal-fired power plants because of the climate damage that's going to be done, it's not consistent to turn around and then approve a project that is going to do the equivalent of, you know, increasing our carbon emissions by, you know, the equivalent of 50 new coal-fired power plants.
And I got to say, in the Guardian piece, you also make this argument that it goes even further than that, that this creates a path dependency, that in some ways, by going down this road, we are set on a trajectory that is very difficult to overcome. You use the example of the QWERTY keyboard, which was simply first to market and may not be the best way to approach typing, but it's what everybody has learned upon, and it exists, and it's almost harder now to reverse it. And I think that really is, and you mentioned in the last segment the notion of whether or not this tar sands oil is going to get out by some other means, and it's very difficult to project that there's going to be 40 times more capacity to take it out by rail. But even more importantly, what you're saying is that if we head down this road, it is going to make future attempts, no matter what they are, to diminish the amount of CO2 we put in the atmosphere, it's going to make it that much harder, and also that much harder for the U.S. to lead.
Yeah, absolutely, because, you know, the construction of this pipeline is a significant investment of capital. It's a long-term investment, and to return on that investment, you know, the oil companies know that they're going to need to keep this going for decades. So to go down this road commits us to, you know, at least another 50 years or more of continued mining of these very dirty sources of fossil fuel energy, precisely at a time when we need to be following the lead set by the rest of the world. India, China, it turns out, are investing far more in renewable energy technology than we are here in the U.S. And what is particularly ironic is this same week that we are talking about the Keystone pipeline, there are a number of articles that have appeared that talk about the a wind tax credit. Congress, Republican-controlled Congress, has allowed the wind energy tax credit to expire. And what that means is that those, you know, investors you know, looking to develop capacity in wind energy face uncertainty in the market because they don't know whether these incentives will continue to exist, and that is deterring investment in renewable energy in wind. And so at the same time that, you know, those many in Congress are arguing that we need to build the Keystone XL pipeline, they seem to be doing all they can to make sure that we don't develop the infrastructure in renewable energy that we need in order to follow the lead being set by the rest of the world that is moving ahead of us economically, recognizing that clean energy is the future.
It it further reinforces that that concept of path dependency by you know, basically shutting off that path. It's as if you were to say, I'm going to go on a diet, and before I do, I'm going to buy a warehouse full of chocolate eclairs, and that's my budget to buy food going forward. But
as good as it sounds, that's exactly right.
Exactly. Well, Michael Mann, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate you talking to us about this.
Thank you, Sam. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
So, Shanna, thank you so much for taking the time. You decided to get into this race against a three-term Senator, Susan Collins. Why?
I'm passionate about positive social change. And when you look at the last 18 years that my opponent, Republican Susan Collins, has served, we've experienced an economic crisis, a constitutional crisis, and an environmental crisis that threaten our country's future. It's time for change in Washington.
All right. So an economic crisis, a social crisis, and one, well, I guess one of surveillance is also an issue for you. Tell us, I mean, give us your perspective on what our challenges are from an economic perspective and how Susan Collins is failing to address that.
Mainers and indeed Americans across the country are really struggling right now, and they feel like Washington isn't listening. They feel like Congress is making decisions that benefit the wealthiest corporations at the expense of our communities. And when you look at rising income inequality, and you look at people here in Maine who are working two or three jobs just to make ends meet, people who are making minimum wage, which isn't enough to put food on the table and heat their homes, people are ready for change. That's what I mean when I describe the economic crisis. Wall Street has recovered, but Main Street here in Maine is not doing well. And the decisions by Republican Susan Collins to oppose the minimum wage increases, decisions to support trade agreements that have shipped jobs overseas without important labor and environmental standards, and the failure to really put in place meaningful Wall Street oversight and reform, these are failures that have a deep impact on American families.
And let's talk about some of the other issues. I mean, you obviously, you're former director of the ACLU in Maine. And so you have a greater, I think, probably sensitivity to the issues of surveillance than many. I mean, give us your take on what's happening in terms of the NSA and everything that we have learned from the Edward Snowden leaks over the past almost year now.
What we've learned is that government surveillance is more intrusive and widespread than we feared. Measures like the USA Patriot Act have undermined civil liberties and also really damaged public trust in government. We need to repeal the Patriot Act. We need to repeal Section 215 and the bulk data collection program. And we need to put in place checks and balances to stop warrantless NSA spying on ordinary Americans. The NSA is spending billions of taxpayer dollars sweeping up the email and phone communications of millions of Americans who are not engaged in criminal activity. This undermines the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, the very values that make us so uniquely American.
Give us your perspective on Edward Snowden. I know that you're on record as saying that he's a whistleblower. Tell us a little bit more about your perspective on what he has, where he fits into this.
I think Edward Snowden sparked a really important debate about the nature and extent of surveillance in America today. He is a whistleblower. He revealed really important information about how widespread this surveillance is and how many Americans it affects. So without his revelations, I think it's unlikely that we would be having this level of public debate today. And it's an important debate to have. In the last decade, we really have departed from the traditional Fourth Amendment right to privacy that was laid out in the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And I think it's important to get back to our fundamental values, constitutional freedoms, to protect individual liberties and also restore public trust in government again.
I know Senator Collins has come out in terms of the that she sees no justification for collecting intelligence on foreign leaders like Chancellor Merkel of Germany. But do you think that she's gone far enough in terms of protecting Americans' right to privacy?
Absolutely not. And this is a clear difference between the two of us. Republican Susan Collins has voted time and time again to renew the Patriot Act without meaningful oversight. She is now a supporter of legislation that would legalize the NSA spying program and actually codify the bulk data collection. And she has refused to sign on to the USA Freedom Act, which would restore checks and balances. So these are clear differences where she favors surveillance, which I think is an overbroad and overreach, and I favor stronger privacy and civil liberties protections.
Now, give us your perspective how you perceive the administration doing in regards to these type of civil liberties questions. You know, there was a lot of anticipation, I think, by those of us, broadly speaking, in the progressive community, that President Obama would change direction from where President Bush had taken us. To what extent do you think the president, what kind of job has he done in that regard?
I think on some issues, the president has done a remarkable job on voting rights, and he's certainly addressing economic inequality in a really exciting way, as represented in his State of the Union speech. I think on NSA spying issues and issues of privacy and surveillance, he needs to do more. I would like to see the president back the USA Freedom Act to restore checks and balances. I would like to see the president put in place, through executive order, limitations on the nature and extent of the surveillance. So I think that the president could do more to improve privacy in this country.
Broadly speaking, when you talk about income inequality, I mean, have we really seen enough action from the administration? I mean, I don't know what more they can do when you have a recalcitrant, Congress. But are the things that you feel that he's left on the table in terms of executive action to address income inequality?
I'm glad you addressed the gridlock in Congress, because that's the real problem. When the Republicans, Mitch McConnell, Ted Cruz, and my opponent, Susan Collins, are really almost oblivious to the needs of working Americans across this country. You know, there are about 96,000 Mainers who make less than $10.10 an hour, and they are really struggling right now to heat their homes, to put food on the table, to cover basic needs. So the president's executive order, in terms of providing for $10.10 an hour as a minimum wage, I think is extraordinarily important leadership. But we need to see Congress follow suit and also index the minimum wage to inflation, so that while the cost of goods and services go up for working Americans all across this country, that the wage will as well.
Okay, we've got to take a brief break. But when we come back, I want to talk about some of the other issues that you've come out strongly in favor of, and I want to also get to the question of Susan Collins as a moderate in the Republican Party, and just get your sense as to whether or not that's even possible, really, in this day and age, with the way that the Republican caucus exists. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Shenna Bellows, running for Senate in Maine in 2014, just after this. So, Shenna, before the break, we were talking about some of the issues dealing with civil liberties. And obviously, that's an area where you have a tremendous amount of experience, having worked with the ACLU. And this is an area where Susan Collins is certainly not on the side of those who believe that the NSA has overstepped their boundaries, and that the Patriot Act is exposing Americans to an undue amount of, or I guess a tremendous infringement upon their privacy. But I want to turn to another issue, because one of the things that made some noise over the past, I guess, a month, it was announced that you had raised more in the last quarter than Susan Collins, who is a three-term senator. What do you attribute that to, A? And B, how does that relate into your perspective on campaign finance?
We were thrilled to raise more money than Susan Collins in our first quarter in the race, and I attribute it to grassroots momentum. We had an initiative to obtain a $5 contribution from every town in Maine, and people started sending in $5, $25. We had over 1,600 donors, grassroots donors, giving to our campaign, and that's how we were able to raise over $330,000, and 80% of our money was from Maine. And 80% of our contributors gave at $100 or less. So it really was fueled by grassroots contributions from real people. And I think that this is where we need to go in this country. Unfortunately, money in politics is a huge threat to our democracy. And these campaigns, I'm a carpenter's daughter from Hancock, Maine. I grew up without electricity or running water. I'm working class. And you know, one of the things I've been saying is carpenter's daughters don't usually run for federal office because these campaigns cost millions. That's why we have a Congress of millionaires instead of a Congress that is more representative of the American public. We need working class people to represent working class interests in Congress. The only way we can have a more representative Congress is if we have meaningful campaign finance reform so that the contributions from ordinary people, these small dollar contributions, can be as significant and as meaningful as the largest checks from large corporation PACs.
Yeah, I mean, so what, I mean, let's talk about that, because you know that's an issue that's here in. I'm obviously speaking from New York State. There's a big issue as to whether or not Governor Andrew Cuomo is really going to make a make good on his pledge to institute a campaign finance system. Some publicly financed system in this state. It remains to be seen if he's actually going to maintain that pledge. But I mean, what can be done on a federal level? I mean, is this something that we want a politician who is out there who has the platform of being a federal senator, just creating pressure within the context of the state, or is there something that can be done on a federal level? I mean, what's your sense of that?
I think we absolutely need federal reform. So in Maine, we have a clean election system. It's a public funding system for candidates to receive matching funds for small dollar contributions. And what that has yielded is a legislature that is truly representative of Maine. There's socioeconomic diversity, age diversity, geographic diversity. We have fishermen, forest products workers, teachers serving in the legislature representing Maine. And that has yielded, I think, a really healthy public policy debate when you have people from all walks of life who are able to serve. I think we can do that at the federal level. There's some exciting movement in terms of policy proposals and bills introduced in Congress for meaningful campaign finance reform. And I think it's important that we have fresh energy, that we have new people willing to lead on this issue and willing to show the way in reforming our campaign finance system to increase the power of ordinary Americans and grassroots participation in politics.
Now, if you are successful in defeating Susan Collins, you would be, as far as I know, the first senator to support the legalization of marijuana. What is it that you've seen that, in your perspective, on what has led you to take that position?
As head of the ACLU of Maine, I've done extensive work on criminal justice issues and in Maine's prison and jails. And what we witnessed, both in Maine and nationwide, is extraordinary high rates of incarceration. The United States incarcerates more people than any other country in the world and more people per capita than any other country in the world. And when you look at people who are in prison and jail for nonviolent drug offenses, the numbers are staggering. And the disproportionate impact on people of color, the racial discrimination in our criminal justice system, is what people are calling the new Jim Crow. And that's why I'm so passionate about decriminalization and of nonviolent drug offenses and focusing on a health perspective rather than a punitive perspective. And that has brought me to the position of supporting legalization. I think that we should not be criminalizing behavior that people engage in on their own time. And there's something very deeply wrong when the last three presidents of the United States acknowledge recreational marijuana use while young, primarily poor, primarily men of color are being incarcerated for the same behavior.
And you know, you mentioned the idea of sort of treating drug addiction as a sort of a as a health issue. Just I guess this last week, your governor in Maine, Paul LePage, has seemingly will oppose a bill that will increase access to an anti-overdose medication called naloxone, I guess it is. Obviously you're running for federal Senate, but just give me your perspective on that, because that just seems to be it's ill-founded in terms of science. It just seems to be a strange position to take, frankly, when this could save lives.
It's completely counterproductive. It is. It's completely counterproductive. He's doubling down on the war on drugs, arguing for more investment in cracking down, quote-unquote, on users and people who have problems with drug abuse, and not backing a very affordable treatment for people who are struggling with addiction, a treatment that would save lives. I think it's exactly the wrong approach. What we have seen over the last 40 years is that the war on drugs has failed miserably. It has cost this country billions economically, and we haven't seen any reduction in use or abuse over that time period. So it's time for a different approach. It's time for a healthier approach that elevates the importance of prevention and education and funds those programs adequately.
And we've seen the success of that drug, in Quincy, Massachusetts, where you had police and firefighters carrying naloxone as part of just sort of the standard equipment that they carry. And they reversed 188 drug overdoses in Quincy alone. Quincy's not necessarily a very big place. I don't know. That struck me as just another one of your governor up there just seems to be vindictive in some way. It's strange to us, I guess, us downstaters. Let's move on to look at Senator Collins. You know, she has always positioned herself as a moderate, and certainly at times we'll talk that way, but it seems that she can't really function as a moderate in the sort of the new Republican Party, and de facto ends up not being one.
I think that's true. I think, and keep in mind that the very first vote cast in the Senate in 2015 will be for Senate Majority Leader. And it is not moderate to vote for Mitch McConnell or next year Ted Cruz to lead the Senate. And to vote then, and that decision then determines committee chairs. Control of the Senate is extraordinarily important. It's also not moderate to vote for Supreme Court judges like Alito and Roberts, who brought us Citizens United, brought us repeal of parts of the Voting Rights Act, and now may bring us horrible decisions that fundamentally alter women's reproductive freedom in this country. And then in terms of actual votes, she has voted with her party over the interests of Mainers and Americans on some key issues. For example, as a leader in the Coalition for Maine Women, our top priority was pay equity, equal pay for equal work for women and men. Susan Collins voted no to the Paycheck Fairness Act. I was a leader in the Maine Choice Coalition advocating for reproductive freedom, and access to contraception is so important, and it's supported by 90%, over 90% of all Americans support full and fair access to contraception. Susan voted for the Blunt Amendment to allow employers to make the decision about whether employees would have access to birth control through health plans. That's not moderate. Those votes are votes where the right wing of the Republican Party votes against women's rights and against reproductive choice that are very concerning, especially coming from a state like Maine, which is such a solid, progressive state and has been a real leader on these issues.
Now, let me. So I know you've gotten endorsed by the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, which, you know, we've on this program spoken to Adam Green many times. And they were one of the big forces behind helping Senator Elizabeth Warren get elected. Obviously, there was a huge support for her in Massachusetts as well. But I mean, so give us a sense of just how hard your job is going to be in terms of actually winning this election. Susan Collins obviously has been in the Senate now for 18 years. She's well known to people in Maine. You've outlined how, you know, on some level, not only is she not lived up to her so-called moderate reputation, but she also essentially enables Republican Party politics in the Senate. And, you know, we could be looking at a situation where the Republicans take over the Senate in 2014. What do you need to do, and how are you going to go about doing it to win this election?
I was one of the leaders of the Mainers United for Marriage campaign in Maine to pass same-sex marriage. We lost in 2009. And so in 2012, when we decided to go to ballot to affirmatively pass the freedom to marry for same-sex couples, many outside observers said, don't do it. It's too soon. You just lost 3 years ago. It's impossible. We said, we think we have the right message, and we know we have a sophisticated grassroots infrastructure to do the field work that we need to do to win. And we did. I am taking lessons that I learned as a leader on the Mainers United for Marriage campaign and applying it to this campaign. We are building an extraordinary grassroots field operation here on the ground. And we know that Mainers are struggling. They feel like Washington is not listening to their economic concerns. And there's a great deal of frustration about how out of touch Washington has become with these traditional values, the respect for the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. So I'm really excited. Of course, it's a David and Goliath race. But just remember, David won.
Oh, there you go. Shenna Bellows, your site is bellowsforsenate.com. If people want to head over there to find a way of helping you as you attempt to win this election, I appreciate your time today.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
And I will pay.